This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Dan Ariely says his life as a social scientist might not have happened if it were not for an accident that nearly killed him. At the age of 17, a chemical explosion caused third-degree burns on about 70% of his body. But it was during those 3 years in a hospital bed, unable to move, that he started studying the nuances of human behavior and asking himself questions about his daily existence. Is it better to rip off my bandages quickly or remove them slowly? Why do those doctors think a lie is sometimes better than the truth? It was the beginning of a career dedicated to finding out why we are such logical but irrational beings. Today, Dan is a world-renowned social scientist. He writes a weekly advice column for the Wall Street Journal called Ask Ariely and fields questions like, how do I encourage my girlfriend to get laser eye surgery? Or how do I get my kids to eat their vegetables? And why are we drawn to food labels that say all natural? Dan can answer all of it, and he will answer your questions today. Dan Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. His newest book is called Irrationally Yours, and he joins me now on The State of Things. Dan Ariely, welcome back. Good to have you here.
A pleasure being back.
And so happy that you'll be taking calls today. You can get free advice. Call us at 877-962-9862. Send us an email to sot@wunc.org or tweet us at hashtag AskDan. You've been on the show before, and you talked about your limited mobility. Tell us about what you started to notice in human behavior as you lay in your bed.
So there are lots of things, but I'll give you maybe one of the strangest ones. So I had a feeding tube for a very long time, and they would feed me 30 eggs a day and about 7,000 calories because there was, you have to, if you have burns, you have to give the body enough energy and material to reconstruct. And I remember maybe after 4 months of the feeding tube, they took it out and I had to eat. And eating seemed like such a terrible chore. Like, you know, I was used to the feeding tube. It seemed so natural by that point. And all of a sudden, the whole aspect of chewing, first of all, I didn't really remember how to chew. Like, you know, you think about it, it's so natural. You know, that's what we do many times a day. I do think about how do we chew and how often do we chew and when do we swallow and how do we do it? And the whole process looked unhygienic and time-consuming. So that's just, a strange part of this. But this idea of observing life from an outside perspective goes to lots of things. When you're involved in romance, you're in it, you see it as natural. When you're outside of it, the whole courting festival looks very strange. Placebos was another thing that you and I talked about before. So at that time, there was the belief that if you give too much morphine to patients, they will become addicted to morphine. And they would give us a budget of how much morphine we could get, and we as patients could decide when in the day we wanted it to give us some control. And sometimes at night, one of the patients would cry and ask for more morphine. And I would track my own morphine consumption, but I also tracked other people's. I'm that obsessive. And I knew they were getting too much. And I would ask the nurse, and I say, hey, this person got extra morphine. Can I get some more? And the nurse told me they only got water with some salt, IV fluid. And I remember how shocked I was that I didn't know if they were lying to me or not. I assumed they were telling the truth. And I was shocked to be in tremendous pain, knowing that the people next to me in the room next to me are in similar pain, to know that they got an injection with nothing but IV fluid and going to sleep. And this fascinated me. And I started reading about placebos. And it turns out that placebos are real. So that when you expect something to happen, when you get an injection from a physician and you think it's a painkiller, your body starts secreting a painkiller. We have this internal capacity to create painkillers. Substance is very much like morphine. Just comes from inside of our brain. And all of a sudden, we create it to kind of help along the injection. So this created tremendous interest between the outside world and the inside world and how these two interact.
And the converse of that, and by the way, when we had you on, I mean, the statistic at the time was that placebos work 50% of the time. So half the time you get a placebo with no medicine at all, it works just as well as getting the medicine.
Yeah, and
don't tell the pharmaceutical industry that.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing because we get it for free. Kind of nature has helped us heal ourselves. We have this amazing machine, right? The body is not a static machine. It's a dynamic machine, and your expectation change your experience. If you go to a meal and you expect it to be wonderful, it will be different than if you think it will be terrible. If you sit and you drink the coffee that we're drinking now and you think to yourself about it, you will enjoy it. And if you mindlessly just consume coffee, you will not enjoy it. So this interaction between the body and the mind is really very important, and we haven't really floated it enough to take advantage of it.
No, and again, you've pointed out the converse of this in your talks. You can see an optical illusion, right, and whatever it is, and we've all seen them, we've all been fooled by them, and then we measure the two tables or whatever it is, and we say, oh, in fact, although they look different, they are identical. And there's no amount of information that you can get,
yes.
No number of times you can measure that will tell the eye, so now please see them as equal. You just won't.
Right. And this is a good analogy for gut intuition, right? So if you think about your eye as being saying, here's the outside world, here's what it means. Gut intuition is kind of like that, where you see things in the outside world and you say to yourself, this is what it means in vision, in social perception and so on. And the idea is that as long as we rely on our brain to process the information, we have to understand that there's going to be some biases. And we're basically served some processed information that is not accurate. So the brain is kind of a waiter that takes some information, some food, digests it, changes it, and so on, and serves us something that is different than the real world.
Well, this is our perception of the brain, unfortunately, and probably a faulty one, that somehow there's this tool up there that actually sees the world as it is and then analyzes it, when in fact it's making templates, right? I mean, you see life as an infant, you make no sense of that at all. The brain begins to make templates and measure stuff that's new input against what it already knows. So those prejudices are how we think. I mean,
and we also don't have the capacity to analyze everything from scratch. So you can kind of sympathize with the brain, right? We give the brain too much information to process. So what is the brain going to do? Is it going to process everything all the time? Of course not. It's going to make some assumptions that are correct much of the time, but then fill in the gaps based on expectation. That's why we have this thing we call top-down and bottom-up. And bottom-up is the idea that we perceive the world from the information into our brain. And top-down means that the brain starts with some assumption about what we're going to see and then fills the gap in the way that it expects to have this information.
I'm talking to Dan Ariely today, social scientist who plumbs the depths of our irrational minds and gets to the bottom and sometimes the top of it all. You can call us at 877-962-9862. He's got a column in the Wall Street Journal called Ask Ariely, where he fields all kinds of questions that have to do with the silliness of our thought process, and yet it is so sublimely human that I can't even laugh at it. We have an emailer, Diana has just sent in an email and says, what words can I say or use with my 6-year-old daughter to make her practice her viola every day without complaint? There is currently much procrastination, plus even when I tempt her with rewards, and I know you're working in rewards right now, when I tempt her with rewards, she still fights practice every step of the way. What do I do?
Yes. So, of course, you can think of it as the viola problem, or you can think of it as procrastination, which is a general human problem. And we all procrastinate, right? There's lots of things that we don't do well, that we should do and we don't.
Right.
Now, if you think about it, what are good human habits? If you had to kind of count the kind of things that we do every day when we should do every day, they're basically very few. There are two that I can think about, which is brushing our teeth and wearing seatbelts. And both of those are interesting case studies. So wearing seatbelts started with big fines and kids screaming in the back. And after a while, we feel now that something is wrong. So even if your car is not beeping and there's no fine and your kid is not in the car anymore, you get into the car and you feel something is wrong, right? So we had to get to this through period of adjustment when we felt that this is the right way to behave and so on. By the way, you would think that people would wear seatbelts because they care about their lives. But it turns out it's not important enough. We need fines and kids screaming and so on.
Right.
The other one is toothbrushing. And toothbrushing falls in the category of what we call reward substitution. So you could say, well, people brush their teeth because we want to have healthy teeth in 30 years from now, and we don't want to have a cavity in 2 years from now. But, you know, if that was the case, we would floss. Because the reality is that flossing is much more important than toothbrushing. But most people don't floss. And if they floss, they don't floss enough, right? There are very few people who floss enough. So what is it about toothbrushing that got it to work? And what happened was that Procter & Gamble, in their infinite wisdom, put mint in the toothpaste. And now you're brushing your teeth not because you think about 30 years from now, but because you think you're socially unacceptable without your breath feeling minty fresh. And probably you and the listeners now as well are kind of filling their mouth and saying, am I missing some mint? So what's interesting with mint is we don't consume it a lot. It's not a regular a staple. Right. But we've connected it with oral hygiene. And because of that, we connect it with that and we start craving it. So if we use something that we use in cooking or other things, in general, it wouldn't work as well. But taking something else extra is important. So why do we brush our teeth? Because we crave mint. And this is the way to get our mint fix. And this is also why we don't floss, because we have enough mint from toothbrushing. We don't need the extra little mint on the table. So let's go back to the viola question. Mm-hmm. The question is, would a six-year-old kid be sufficiently motivated to play the viola every day? The answer is no. It's just not going to happen. But what a parent needs to do is to think about what is the reward substitution that we can find.
I'm going to hold you right there.
Okay.
Diana, you're going to have to wait for your answer. Well, we'll find out what reward substitution may get Diana's violist to practice regularly when our conversation with Dan Ariely continues. You can join us too. 877-962-9862 if you want to join the conversation. SOT@WNC.org for an email on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest, Duke social scientist Dan Ariely, prominent behavior economist who studies the irrational side of human behavior. He's written does write an advice column for the Wall Street Journal called Ask Ariely. You can do that, too, by calling us at 877-962-9862 or sending us an email at WNC.org, as Diana has done. You can also use the hashtag AskDan on Twitter. So the question for Diana is, how do I get my six-year-old to practice the viola? And you were talking about incentives and how those work.
Yeah, and just so it's clear, it's not just about the viola. We're trying to think about the problem more okay. generally. So we said we need to create a reward that is immediate, right? Nobody really cares about what will happen to them 30 years from now, so we really need to think about what satisfaction am I getting from this now? And you can think about two types of reward. One is internal or inherent, and one is external. So the external one is easy. You can pay people, or you can give kids toys, or you could do all kinds of things. The problem with that is that at some point, if the reward goes away, the behavior goes back. So if you take your employees or your siblings or your kids and you say, I'll pay you $3 every time you do X, and then at some point you stop paying them, they're not necessarily going to keep on enjoying the behavior. Now, they might, right? You might say, well, viola is one of those things that the learning function is very, very painful, and we just have to focus on getting right over this learning function. And once you learn how to do it, it will come pleasurable and fulfilling and so on. I don't know if that's the case. But if that was the case, then you could think about a short-term reward until you go over the hump. I think reading is one of those cases mm-hmm. where initially nobody enjoys reading and you need to get to this. The other more promising direction, though, is to find a part of the activity that can be enjoyable. So, for example, can you take a song that you really like and as a reward for playing the viola as you should, play that song that you really like? Or if you like, if you don't like cooking, can you take something you really enjoy eating and put it as part of the meal? So it's not just an external reward, but it's something that is actually connected with the experience. And then there's another element to this thing, which is consistency. And this goes back to the idea of rules. So here's the thing. If every time you sit and you ask yourself, should I behave well or should I behave badly? Many times you would say, today, let me behave badly. So you say to yourself, should I be on a diet or not? And then you basically say, well, today, maybe not. And if you have to make that decision every day, there's a good chance you will fail every day. So think about what religion has done. What religion has done is to create rules for behavior that are really not up to you as an individual. They define what good behavior means. And every time you misbehave, you're not just misbehaving that day, you're kind of offending the gods and you're changing who you are. So think about lying. If you lie in the Catholic tradition, or steal, or whatever, you're not just doing it, but you've kind of tainted yourself as a human being, and then you have to go to confession to clean yourself up, right? If you think about recycling, and you say recycling is not just about every day, is this saving the municipality enough money or not, but you say this is what a good human being does, and if I stop doing it even one time, I'm changing who I am deeply in terms of my identity and rules and so on, then it has a bigger effect. So the other thing I would do is I would try to get this activity to become a bigger part of that person's identity. So what are you? You are a person who is a musician. And the meaning of musician is that you practice every day. And if you're not doing it, it's not that you decided on Tuesday not to do it. It's that you're not being the musician you want to be. So it's not just about what you do. It's about who you are. And that creates a higher meaning. I'll give you a ridiculous story. For me, I travel a lot, way too much. And one of the challenges with traveling is, of course, the temptation of all kind of bad food. So, you know, 11 p.m., I land somewhere, room service, you know, like a dry lettuce in a salad or, you know, something unhealthy. The unhealthy, for some reason, you know, lasts the marks of time much better. So I gave myself a rule, and my rule is that I don't eat bread or pasta. And I'm not allergic to anything. But as a rule, it really helps me keep track of that. Right?
But let me stop you there, because I think you've really raised, you've created quite an impression here. First of all, again, getting back to the idea that we make all the stuff is in our head. So even if with religious authority or your rule, right, or the identity, who are you? Ultimately, we have to believe in the ultimacy of that authority, mm-hmm. don't we? I mean, somehow or other, and maybe this becomes the problem of public policy. If you have people who don't believe the same way you do about the ultimate authority, then the rule you create is going to have more or less impact or more or less hold on the individual, because it comes down to my impression of how important that authority or real that authority is that made the rule giver, right?
That's right. And it's kind of interesting how we believe in our own authority. So imagine the following study. Imagine that you're selling a car, and we talked on the phone, and I said, I'm going to buy this car for X thousands of dollars. I'll be there tomorrow. And then somebody comes before me and offer you more money, right? How obligated you would feel to me. Versus imagine a case in which you do the same thing, but we meet face to face and we shake hands, or maybe kind of in a Tom Sawyer approach, we, you know, spit in our hands and shake it, or, you know, cut or do something else. What happened is that your commitment to your own decision is going to be much higher, and you'll give up more money for that. So kind of our version of who we are and how committed to it can also be changed. If you say to yourself something in passing, oh yes, I will not eat bread, it doesn't mean that much. But if you start thinking about it and you kind of make it as a part of your identity, you talked about it to other people, you do the equivalent of shaking your own hand and maybe cutting your own finger to mix the blood. All of those things reinforce the fact that we have made a commitment. And it is so interesting that I am a person of my word is an important thing. And the moment people make a commitment within this role, they do become the authority. And you're right that in policy, we haven't taken this, right? So you look at patients. What's your drug adherence? Is what your doctor tells you. That's one authority. But as a patient, what ownership have you taken? What kind of commitment have you made? Where is your honor connected to the fact that you'll start taking care of your health?
Which points at least to the possibility that if there's any hardwiring, it is to our need to be socially connected and therefore socially approved of. And so anything, I'll just go ahead and posit this and then you can straighten me out, but that anything that strengthens our social connection and acceptability is something we're more likely to adhere to, whatever the rule and whatever the form, in any culture. And that which doesn't really make us more sound and improve our status within that group has a softer bond.
Yeah, the social element of human being is something, by the way, that escaped economists, right? So the model of human beings in economics is a model for the individual. It's not a model of a group. And the idea of maximization, kind of unselfishness, Ayn Rand kind of approach, is very much the hallmark of economics. But we are deeply, deeply social. And here's just one way to think about it. There's something called the trust game. And trust game is a very simple game. You and I play together. We don't know each other. We're not in the same room. And you get $100. And the experimenter says, hey, Frank, you could do two things with these $100. You can either keep it for yourself and go home. You'll be $100 richer. Or you can send it to this anonymous person you're paired with. You don't know them. They'll never find out and so on. If you send them the money would quadruple. So it would become $400 by the time the other person would get it. And that then the other person could do one of two things. They can either keep the money and go home, or they can send you back half of it. So now you as Frank has a dilemma. You have a dilemma. What do you do? Are you selfish or are you trusting? Well, the economic theory would say if you send the money away, the other person will be selfish, so don't send the money to start with. But good news is most people are not economists. Most people send the money and most people reciprocate. So the total good is increasing. But if you think about this, it's two cases in which economics get things wrong. You should not send the money, and if you send it, I should not send it back. But in fact, that's what people do. It's because we have tremendous pressure for social obligation and social commitment. That's the process of socialization, and it's something that we need to understand much better and actually take advantage of it. And I'll give you one simple example. I'm headed off to England on Sunday. The British government has started doing all kind of experiments on people. And one of the first experiments they did was to get people to pay their taxes. And, you know, nobody objects.
Jack, how's that going?
So it's going incredibly well. And you know what's the best thing to get people to pay their taxes? Is to send them a note that says 8 out of 9 people in your district have already paid their taxes. Mm. And that ends up working better than frightening people, better than fines, because when we know how other people behave, we feel compelled to act in the same time, and then we follow up and we behave in the same way. So understanding the social influences is a tremendous, it's interesting, but also it's a tremendous tool for getting people to behave in all kinds of better ways.
How do we then, I mean, this gets to some of these sort of political questions about, I mean, we have a question here from Durward, who wants to know about people who don't believe in climate change. There's a lot of evidence. It's scientific. And yet people just sort of say, well, I'll take science to a point, but that science I don't like. And so, what explains this kind of behavior?
So actually, one of the students working with me, Troy Campbell, just graduated, sadly, because he was a delight to have. He had a couple of papers on something really interesting. And what he showed is that people don't necessarily don't believe in climate change. They just hate the process by which we're going to work on it. So he basically finds that, imagine that I tell you that the way to diet is just going to be extremely painful. You basically say, oh, I don't need to diet. And if I tell you that the process of getting into a diet is just not that bad, you say, yes, I'll do that. So what he finds is that much of the objection of the Republican right wing, it seems like it's an objection to climate change, but in fact, it's not an objection for climate change. It's an objection to what we're going to do as a society to deal with this problem. So imagine that you don't believe in government intervention and you don't believe in cutting expenditure and you don't believe in limiting your consumption and you don't believe in more taxes and so on. So you basically object to every possible way that you can think that we're going to fight climate change. What you're going to say, don't worry about climate change. That's not the problem. So what Troy is showing very nicely is that if we can convince people that it will be less painful to deal with this, they actually are much more likely to believe it.
Well, what about that? You get back to identity. Getting back to our young viola player, if I can convince her that you are a musician, your future, not only your future, but this is who you are. If I am the person who believes that government is the problem,
yep,
we'll stick with that. How do we unseat that? Can you ever convince me it's not going to be as painful as that when I've staked my entire identity on opposing the intervention or of these authorities who will now tell me how to behave?
So the said answer is going to be very, very difficult. I don't like answers that says impossible.
Right.
I'll tell you about one way that we have tried to think about how to do it. So we've worked on this question of perception of inequality in the U.S. And you know, Republicans and Democrats have very different views of what should be done and so on. And we try to say, well, how do we get people to be less committed to their own position, and how do we get people to observe things in more objective ways? How do we get people to distance themselves? And there is this notion that every time you become an advisor to somebody, you take a third-party perspective, you're more objective. So how do we get people to be third-party observers?
Mm-hmm.
So we took the definition of John Rawls. John Rawls was the famous philosopher, and he said, a just society is a society that if you knew everything about it, you would be willing to join it in a random place, right? And it's a very beautiful definition because it means that you could be among the wealthier, you could be among the poorest. You have to consider all perspective. And when we take Republicans and Democrats, rich and poor, Americans and British, all kinds of people, people who listen to NPR, people who read Forbes magazine, and we ask them, what kind of world would you build in terms of wealth inequality that you will be willing to join in a random place? And you could say, well, you know, we want some inequality to give people motivation, but we want the poor to not be desperate. I mean, there's all kinds of consideration. We find that people build a very equal society, actually much more equal than Sweden. And we find that the differences between Democrats and Republicans are basically tiny. And So this is another thing to do is right now people are committed to their perspective. And the question is, how do we separate them and get them to think about it in a more distant way? And I'm kind of imagining that one day we'll do sim politics. So you remember SimCity and
yeah,
SimAnd?
Yeah.
Where you basically get to apply your assumptions about how people work into a world and you see what the outcome is. So you say, hey, I believe in high inequality. Let's see just how it works, right? And at what point do people start rioting? At what point you have no workforce that is educated? And what are the long-term ramifications? I think we could do that. If the system would take our assumption and just play it out for us in multiple periods, I think people would realize more what are the implications of what they're saying.
But do we have the time? I think the fear is that if I let go of this, it's all going to go very quickly in the wrong direction. In other words, in real time, we don't have time to play sim politics because if we let this go any further, it's over.
Yeah, I think we need to play it, you know, one time, 3 weeks before the elections.
Hey, you know what? I've only got about 4 minutes in this segment left, but you also looked at the way form plays an important part in our decision making, and form meaning in one case forms. You talk about organ donation and kind of how, again, another insight into how we make decisions. We would think organ donation is a very rational conclusion or thought.
Yeah, so you would think that people would say, I want to donate my organs or not, and that's kind of the decision. But it turns out that if the form is structured in a way in which you have to sign to donate, people don't sign and don't donate. And if the form is organized, this is the form of the DMV, and if the form is organized in a way that you have to sign to opt out, not to donate, people do the same thing. They don't sign, but now they donate. And it's actually a terribly important insight because it means that we walk around the world thinking that we're making decisions. But the reality is that the form designers end up making many of those for us. And you know, nobody grows up and say, when I grow older, I want to be a form designer. But that's actually what I want to do because forms are the interfaces between governments and citizens, companies and individuals. And if we understand that those are the decision environment that people get, designing them in a better way would yield a much better outcome.
So we should think about that too when we read poll results. How is the question asked? How is it framed? You're going to get very different answers.
We should think about it in interpreting data. We should think about it when we go into the supermarket and we ask, how is the design of this supermarket changing my behavior? We should think about it in terms of what our websites that are designed to do all kinds of things to us, our financial advisors, our physicians. The environment plays a big role. And sometimes we don't understand it, how it plays, and we end up making decisions that are not necessarily the decisions we would have liked to me.
You know, you talk about financial advisors. It's interesting. You have said that people, for instance, in most cases, if you have any kind of a brokerage account, there's a certain percentage that goes to pay for that. And people are pretty much okay with that. Less likely to pay for finance. And you've got a broker who's sort of working on the account and making those kinds of money, that money. So there's a kind of, you know, inherent conflict of interest that we understand. We sign off on it. And
I'm
people
not sure
less,
I understand, but we sign
understand
off on it, yeah.
fully. But we do sign off. We read some document somewhere that said this is the relationship. And yet, if we were to pay somebody just sort of an objective observer with some financial expertise, we're less likely to do that. Just pay the fee up front.
That's right. So, and I've asked this question to many people. I said, okay, you have a financial advisor. You pay them 1%. Imagine that instead you would write them a check in the beginning of each month for the same amount. What would you demand from them, and how unhappy would you be? People are pissed off.
And my guest today, social scientist Dan Ariely, professor of behavioral economics at Duke University, writes a weekly advice column for the Wall Street Journal. Hey, we're taking your calls. Call us at 877-962-9862. With questions for Dan, you can send us an email at sot@wnc.org or tweet us at #AskDan. There's more of The State of Things just ahead. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Duke social scientist Dan Ariely, who has spent his career studying irrational behavior and what we might do to deal with it, cope with it, internalize it, and, you know, make the best use of it. He writes a weekly advice column for The Wall Street Journal, and his newest book, Irrationally Yours, is based on that column. He's written three best-selling books, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, Upside Down Irrationality, and Predictably Irrational. You can call Dan today and put your question to him, 877-962-9862, emails at sot@wnc.org. The emails you get, I mean, there really was. I mean, somebody wanted to know how he could convince his girlfriend that laser surgery would be best for her. It worked for him to improve his eyesight. And
actually, I got the response. She had committed. So they followed the advice, and she committed to doing it, and I think she's doing it in a month or so.
What was the advice?
So basically, the advice in this case was multifaceted. So this was a guy who did it himself, and his girlfriend was very interested in doing it, but she was taking her time, and he thought, you know, time is of the essence. Like, why wait a few more years and not have good sight and keep on struggling with glasses and contact lenses? So one of the issues was how to make this timely. So I basically suggested to him to use financial incentives and loss aversion. So to basically say that he was going to pay for a part of this, but the payment is only valid for 2 months. So the money is there, the offer is there, but there's a deadline connected to it. And then I said, on top of that, what you could do is you could add a social element to this. So instead of just you and her doing this, ask all her friends to participate as well, and ask her friends to participate in this deadline as well. So all of a sudden it became a social proof. So I suggested that, and he wrote me back that he did that. He said, plus he took, he asked everybody who donated, all the friends, to take angry pictures, like of themselves, as if they are, you know, looking down, you know, get going, and she has committed to do the surgery. So,
well, I guess that's okay, and I do hope it turns out all right. 877-962-9862, the number to call to join the conversation with Dan Ariely, as John has done from Pittsburgh. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. You have a question?
Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Yeah, I was wondering, with all the new polling technologies available, and as you said, the importance on writing accurate forms, has there been any kind of concerted effort from a politician to use these technologies to get a more accurate view of their constituency's views on things? It seems voting's kind of gotten out of touch with people's views.
Thanks, John.
So a couple of things. There are some technologies people are trying to improve. It also turns out to be more complex to do. So, for example, there was a beautiful study that looked at how people vote when the voting station is in the school versus in a church. And if you know exactly what you're going to vote, of course, it doesn't matter. But if you're kind of in the middle and you go to a church, people end up voting more conservative. You go to a school, you vote in a different way. And those are things that, you know, we don't know which polling station you'll be at. So the idea that the environment matters is incredibly important. The other thing, very sadly, that politicians are doing is they're using polling techniques not to measure what people are going to do, but to influence them. So the most famous, infamous example for this is in the Bush-McCain. There was a question that the people from the Bush campaign called people, and they said, would you be surprised to find out that McCain had a child with his illegitimate African-American mistress? And, you know, they didn't say anything. They just said, would you be surprised? And then, of course, McCain has an adopted child who is African. And you see the pictures afterward. And this idea of using questions to implant ideas into people's mind is actually incredibly, incredibly powerful. And more politicians are doing that. So less on the polling side and more on the intervening in people's mind side.
Yeah. Well, and there are push polls, too, that try to get the information out there. And again, you've manipulated the question to get the result you wanted. But I would think that the campaign itself might have an internal poll to get a real pulse, a real finger on the pulse.
Right. Right? So people are trying to get the real one for themselves. They're trying to influence it for other people. There is an interesting question. Whether people would go to vote more if they thought that nobody's voting or if they thought that everybody's voting. Hmm. And think about it, right? If you think that nobody is voting, you say, hey, my vote will count as more. But if you think that everybody is voting, you say that's the normal behavior. So there was a beautiful study showing that getting people to think that everybody is voting, even though their vote is going to be less impactful, they actually go to vote more. So we follow the herd in voting rather than care about how much our voting really matters.
Even if you think, because that does seem to be the other side of this, is that people feel like my one vote doesn't matter. And you would think that feeling would increase the more voters. But you're saying that's not the case.
Empirically, the two forces work against each other. But if you think that everybody's voting, you say that's the right behavior. I would feel bad not doing this. We did one more thing on voting is we created a campaign in which there was a face of a kid and they looked up at the parents and say, Mommy, Daddy, what did you vote? And the idea was that when you think about not voting, it's kind of a selfish act. You say, well, you know, my time is worth more than going to vote and being a good citizen. But you probably don't want to tell your kid exactly that, right? Oh, kid, you know, I'm a little too lazy. When we deal with our kids, we're more ideological. This is why we wear seatbelts. We do all kinds of things in front of our kids. And using kids to harness good behavior is actually a really good path. So we're thinking more and more about how to use kids for better behavior.
Well, and speaking about that behavior, you've taken a look at honesty, dishonesty, when we lie, when we cheat, and you've done some remarkable experiments on that as well.
Yes. So, you know, I actually started working on dishonesty just like everything else, kind of as a one-off. But I started just before 2008. And then when 2008 hit, all of a sudden I realized there was a lot of opportunities to study things.
Too late.
So here's just one example. So one of the tasks we use is called the die task. So I say, look, why don't you roll a die and we'll pay you by whatever the die comes up on. Six, you get $6, five, and so on. And you could decide whether you want to get based on the top side or the bottom side. Top or bottom, you decide, but don't tell me. So we start the trial, and I say, Frank, please pick a side. And you pick top or bottom, don't tell me. And then you roll the die, and let's say it came up with five on the bottom and two on the top. And I say, what did you pick, top or bottom? Now, if you picked bottom, no problem. You say bottom, and you get $5. If you pick top, now you have a dilemma. Do you say the truth, top, and get $2, or do you change your mind after the fact and say bottom and get $5? And people do this 20 times, and every time they think top or bottom, they decide, they roll, and so on. And what you see in the result is that people are really lucky. It's just amazing how much luck people have. And luck is also interesting because it mostly concentrates on the 6-1 die toss rather than the 3-4. So this is the basic thing, and we find that lots of people cheat a little bit. But here's a new version of this. You're doing the same task, but you sit next to your significant other. And your significant other doesn't know what's in your mind top or bottom, but they kind of get evidence of whether you're honest or extra lucky. So what do you think? Do people cheat more, less, or the same when they sit next to the significant other?
I would think they would cheat a little less.
Yeah, so people think less because you care about your impression. Yeah. They actually cheat more.
Huh.
They actually cheat more. Now, why? Let me tell you about another experiment. We'll come back to this. We do the same task and we connect people to a lie detector. And we ask whether a lie detector can detect people's dishonesty. And the answer is basically yes. But in another version of the experiment, people lie for charity. So they pick a charity they really like, and let's say NPR, and they say, all the money I make today goes to that charity. What happens? People cheat more and the lie detector can't detect anything. You see, the lie detector detects this tension between I want more money, but it's wrong. But if it's for charity, it's not wrong, right? So this tension. Now, what happens when you sit next to your significant other? All of a sudden, you don't think you're just cheating for you. You're cheating for the whole family, right? Other people benefit. People don't feel as bad about it, and therefore we cheat more. And the final conclusion from all this research on dishonesty, and we've done lots of it, and lots of it is fun and interesting, is that it's about the ability to rationalize. We have this unbelievable ability to rationalize our behavior in all kinds of ways. We have the ability to see the world in a way we want to see it. And cheating is basically taking advantage of that. We basically cheat a little bit up to the extent that we would feel bad about it. And sadly, that range of cheating is a little too high.
Well, but that also raises the question of what is cheating. I mean, it brings me to what I call human exceptionalism, right? The whole universe, apart from humans, just goes ahead and does what it does. When the leopard takes down a lame antelope baby, nobody says that's immoral. How could you possibly take advantage of that poor thing? That's what leopards do. And humans somehow have to hew to two imperatives: their own need to do whatever it is they need, and this need to be socially acceptable, which has imposed all these rules on them. So that makes us kind of different, huh?
It does make us very different. And we lie in a very different way. So let's think about monkeys. If you're a monkey and you're a hierarchy of monkey, and if you find a nice fruit, you should bring it to the top monkey. That's just kind of the rules. But if nobody sees you, you're going to eat the apple, and you're not going to feel bad about it, right? Now, people, we have to create different structure. We live a very complex life. Think about how much trust you need to create in your neighbors and your babysitter and your accountant. If you basically assume that everybody's out to get you, think about how much of your time you would have to spend protecting yourself from everything else, right? Locking everything, securing everything, never shaking hand. Everything has a contract. So we have to realize that we're getting tremendous benefit from the level of trust. And we've created trust in society. We've also created revenge to kind of help us with trust. We created mechanisms to increase trust naturally and artificially, like with police and so on. But trust is incredibly important in society. And as people lie, they don't just lie to you or to me. They also erode the trust in society. And living in a society with very little trust is very, very dangerous. So think about something like Kenya. I was recently in Kenya. They're one of the world's leader in corruption. And people do all kinds of things. So, for example, there's a new scam now in Kenya where people go and they declare somebody dead. And then they create documents that person has actually transferred their wealth. And they sell it to somebody else. And that person who is not dead and has not transferred the wealth, one day tries to sell their land or something, and all of a sudden discovered that he's been sold already without. Imagine what it is to live in a world like this when you have to protect yourself all the time. It's just a terrible thing to go. So we do have to realize that we've created this amazing society, and it runs to some degree on trust, more than we realize when you just walk around on a daily basis.
Yeah, but how much of what we trust shouldn't we and has become normalized? You talked about corruption, but if you think going back to 2008, how much of those new instruments that nobody quite understood were utterly corrupt? That was corruption of the highest order, and it was greed, which is a vice, none of which gets punished because it's normal. Because a guy goes to work with a suit on Wall Street and has millions of dollars, therefore can't be a criminal. But if they had lust in their heart or sold drugs and had their pants down at their hips, oh, well, now that's a criminal. That guy should be behind bars, right?
Yeah. And I think one of the challenges is being a social scientist is to basically figure out when is the boundary between social responsibility and individual responsibility, which is very hard to do because the moment you believe that the environment matters, kind of how much power does the individual have? But here's the thing. Conflicts of interest erode our ability to see things in an objective way. So imagine that you like a particular sports team. Can you view that sports team in an objective way? The answer is no. Imagine you get to have a big bonus if you can only see mortgage-backed security or robot trading or something else as a really good thing. Can you not see that? So as a society, what we have done is that we don't understand conflicts of interest, and we create a lot of them. Actually, we create a ton of them in medicine, right? I mean, we basically have lots of people who get paid much more if you get sick, and then they get to do an operation on you than if you never get sick. Is that really a good system to build? And can those people that we put in there really see you as anything but a heart waiting for a stent or a knee waiting for a knee replacement? It is not humanly possible for people to view life without conflicts of interest. It's just not what we do. And sadly, we create a world with more and more conflicts of interest. So I think we do have to kind of use science to realize what are the traps for human behavior and to figure out how do we create a society that doesn't create that many traps. On an individual level, imagine every morning I came to your desk and I layered it with donuts. What are the odds that by the end of the year you will be as healthy as you are now? Just not as high. And this donut metaphor is what we do to people all the time. We tempt people to misbehave all the time, and then we expect great behavior. Not going to happen.
Can we do? I mean, are you optimistic? Is there a way, given what you've just said, and we understand now that we don't really operate on a thoroughly rational basis? Do we create that society, or do we just keep muddling along and trying to catch the bad guys as we go?
So I think we are moving forward. I think the British opened an office for behavioral economics. The Americans are now starting a similar approach. There's one in Holland. There's one starting in Israel. There's one in Singapore, in Australia. So I think that's very nice. I also think that there's some really nice non-political organizations that are doing it. So I don't know if you know TROSA. This is one of the organizations here. We had a screening there of my movie on dishonesty, and then I answered some questions to the people there. That's an amazing organization with deep insight into...
It's a substance abuse rehab program that brings people through and ultimately helps to find jobs. But go ahead.
That's right. Yeah. And they've been going on for a long time, and they've been kind of improving and learning and figuring out what they do. So here you take people with tremendous difficulty in substance abuse, and all of a sudden we do behavioral modification that get them to behave much better. And I think programs like this and things like the government do give me hope that we're at least have some movement in the right direction.
All right, Dan, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dan Ariely is a behavior economics professor at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business, also leads the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke, and his new book is called Irrationally Yours. You can find out more information at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Widarski sitting in today. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.